Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. Well, the month of spooky may be done, but the stories are not.
Sure. That sounds fine.
This week, we will continue with more scary stuff from you guys with three more of your stories. These are some of the strangest yet. Also this week, we will resume the novel Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
No way.
We're getting so close to the end, and it is getting exciting.
Oh, good.
Tom Williams is back this week with another tale of growing up, and I won't say much except I hope you don't have a fear of heights. So, with that much to do, we better get it going with this 5-Minute Mystery.
Another 5-Minute Mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by The Best Laid Plans. Are they truly only put out by mice and men? And do they always go awry? According to Robert Burns and the poem, To a Mouse, it always does. Now, for our story.
I tell you, Janice, it's got to be slick.
No, it won't work, Roger. It's too uncertain.
But there's nothing to go wrong. Now listen, those custom boys are used to naive, stupid smuggling. We've got to be smart, that's all.
And you think your idea is?
Look, Janice, why isn't it? We get on the boat. We're strangers. We never speak to each other. No one on the boat can connect us in any way. Now, I get off first, and right away I have my trunk and bags examined. By the time I'm through, you're off and you're waiting. Then...
Yes, but that timing. How can I be sure there won't be a lot of people under letter G and only me at K?
For heaven's sake, Janice, you can stall somehow. We'll be near enough to each other to see how things are going.
Okay, okay.
Then I pick up my three bags and walk over toward you. I'm clumsy and I don't see where I'm going. I bump into you, and as I do, you drop my wallet. I pick it up.
With your hands full of bags, I suppose.
Well, maybe you pick it up. We don't have to rehearse a scene like that. If anyone thinks he sees you drop it, my initials and identification will prove it's mine, especially as I've just been through the customs. It'll look as if I had it in my hand.
Sounds good, Roger.
Good, it's perfect. Why, with the diamond market the way it is, we'll clean up in America, honey.
Roger, if this works, you're a genius.
That all you want to declare, Mr. Griswold?
That's all.
You're clear then, Mr. Griswold. Guess you're glad to be home.
I certainly am. And more than you can guess.
Yeah, it must be pretty tough in Lisbon, even for Americans. Oh, can you manage that packing by yourself?
Oh, yes, thanks. I must be clumsy about this now. Ah, there's Janice, good girl. She's just arrived. Fine. Well, here we go.
Oh!
I beg your pardon.
Well, why don't you look where you're going? Oh, just a minute. I think you dropped this wallet.
What? Oh, yes, yes. I guess I did. Oh, thanks very much.
Wait a minute there. He didn't drop that, miss. You did.
Oh, no, you're mistaken. That isn't my wallet.
Well, indeed it isn't.
I saw you drop it, miss. Say, what's going on here?
Oh, nothing's going on. This gentleman ran into me and dropped his wallet, and I picked it up, and that's all.
How do you know it's his wallet?
Because his initials are on it.
Oh, they are they? What are your names?
Janice Kite.
I'm Roger Griswold, but I don't
Well, Janice Kite and Roger Griswold, you're both under arrest for smuggling. How did the customs official discover their trick? In just a minute, we'll hear. First, a word from our sponsor.
So, we don't have a murder here, and, well, that's a good thing. But we do have a couple of very unsophisticated, really dumb smugglers. That was not a good plan, and I don't think our custom agent had to think very much about it. Let's go find out.
And now, back to our story.
Look here, you can't arrest me for smuggling.
Well, you remember I asked you, Miss Kite, how you knew it was his wallet that had dropped.
Yes.
You said you knew it was his because his initials were on it.
Well, aren't they?
Yes, his initials are there all right, but on the inside. And when the wallet dropped to the floor, it didn't fall open, so you couldn't have seen them. Therefore, I knew you had previous knowledge of them. Yes, you two had a nice little package of 15 diamonds in that wallet. And now, how about a free ride to the station house?
The best laid plans. That's what the creators of this mystery called this one. I think a better title would be How to Get Caught Smuggling Without Really Trying. What a really dumb mystery. And to our criminals, I say, crime does not pay, unless it does. This mystery was brought to you by the best laid plans of mice and men.
What's that you say?
I want to say thank you for your support during the month of Spooky 2018. It was the best yet, and the internet numbers suggest that you must have told a few friends to join us. I can't thank you enough for all the stories you sent in, but there was a problem. I didn't get to them all. So, we're going to hear three more spooky stories this week, right now, from you guys. So let's get to those right now in These Are Your Stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
Our first story is a scary one from Christopher Evans in Newport. I don't know for sure which Newport Christopher is from because, well, there's so many. But if I had to guess, I would go with New York. Christopher writes, "Hey Ron, thank you for the opportunity to share my strange story. I am a long-distance trucker and I've been doing this for about 15 years now. I drive the really big rigs. Because of the size of the trucks, most of my work is done at night. I used to pick up hitchhikers to help pass the time on the lonely roads. Now I listen to podcasts like yours to do the same thing. Why? No more hitchhikers, and here is my story. I was taking a load from New York to Santa Fe. This was a long trip, even for me. I was on a lonely stretch of road somewhere in Oklahoma on Highway 44 when I spotted a hitchhiker. He wasn't asking for a ride, he was just walking along the side of the road, but I was pretty bored, so I decided to stop and pick the guy up. I pulled over and waited for him to catch up. He came along the side of the truck and looked up at me. I rolled down the window and asked if he needed a ride. He gladly accepted, ran around the front of the truck, and hopped in on the other side. The first thing I noticed about him as he got in was that he was clean. Very rare for hitchhikers this far from nowhere. We had gotten about 15 miles, and I was regretting having him along because he was as silent as a church mouse. Absolutely nothing came out of him, and he didn't answer any of the questions I asked. I was about to tell him, "Well, this is as far as I go," when he finally spoke up. "Where are you going anyway?" he said. I decided not to tell him I was on my way to Santa Fe, so I told him that I would be going as far as Elk City, Oklahoma. I remembered just seeing that city on a road sign a few miles back. He replied, "Oh, I better get started then. That's just a few miles away." At that moment, a chill went through my body like I'd never felt before. I literally felt like I was in danger and needed to do something fast, so I said, "What do you need to do?" "Just you never mind. Keep driving, and you'll find out." His voice had changed, and it sounded evil. I'll have no funny business, I said. This is not my first rodeo, and you don't want to mess with me. He became quiet again, but I could hear him moving around nervously in his seat. It was then I heard the crack. I don't know how else to describe it. It wasn't like a weapon click or anything like that. It was like bone-breaking. I looked over at the man to see what the noise was, and what I saw terrified me. His physical form was changing. I slammed on the brakes, managed to get it over to the side of the road, opened the door, and ran. All the while, I felt like I was being chased, until I didn't. I was about 50 feet away from the truck when I glanced back, and there was no one there. Feeling kind of stupid, I walked back to the truck and looked in the cab. The man was gone. I wish there was more to this story. I looked around a bit and couldn't find him. I looked in the truck and nothing was missing or out of place. I thoroughly searched the sleeper and found nothing out of the ordinary there either. I started up the truck and drove to the nearest bar I could find, and to this day, I no longer pick up hitchhikers. Christopher Evans, Newport, New York, I think. What a crazy story, Christopher. Something right out of the annals of terror. I actually thought you reacted better than I would have, but it's my guess as a long-distance trucker, you've probably seen some pretty strange stuff. Thank you for sharing it, Christopher. Our second story comes from Frances Pittman, who coincidentally works as a waitress in a truck stop near Carlin, Nevada. I decided to put this story with Christopher's. Frances writes, "Hello, Ron. I listen to your podcast all the time and decided to send in my story to be part of your month of spooky. I hope it fits the bill. It sure is a head-scratcher, as you're fond of saying. I work at a truck stop just outside of Carlin, Nevada. I've been here about 5 years now and seen some pretty strange stuff, but nothing like the story I'm about to tell you. Thank you for your show, and thank you for what you do. Frances." Here is her story. As you probably might guess, most truck stops are open 24 hours a day. I was working the late shift on a very cold December night. The place was like a tomb, which also should come as no surprise. We had not had a customer in hours when in walks a gentleman. Well, at best, he was a hobo. At worst, well, I'll leave that to your imagination. He came in and sat down at the bar. I walked up to him with a cup and a pot of coffee. It was our policy that the coffee was free to everyone. I poured him a cup. He gratefully accepted it and smiled. I handed him a menu and told him that I would give him a minute and turn my back. When I looked back, he was gone. I looked around and found no sign of him. I checked the restroom, the cafe area, and finally the convenience store. He was gone. He did not go out the main door because it rings every time someone opens it. I asked the night cook if he had seen him or if he had gone out the back. He had not. I thought for sure I had gone nuts. I decided to check the security tapes. They are on a recording loop for 24 hours a day as per regulations. I checked the time that he would have come in, and what I saw to this day I cannot explain. At the time he would have come in, the door opens, but no one enters the building. I made a copy of this recording to prove my story, but most people still think I'm crazy. Frances Pittman, Carlin, Nevada. Well, Frances, that's not only a head-scratcher, but it's chilling. The fact that you have a tape showing a door moving on its own is some scary stuff. I'm guessing the coffee at your truck stop must be pretty darn good. Thank you for your story, and thank you for listening to Ron's Amazing Stories. Our last story comes from Jesse Richardson of Seattle, Washington. Jesse writes, I don't listen to many podcasts, but yours is one I never miss. I look forward to hearing you each week and wanted to do my part. This is a true story, but I have no way to prove that it happened. All of the folks involved will confirm their involvement, but that's as far as it will go. I offer it as is. I'm an IT guy by day and a musician by night. I am a member of a band called Mindful, and we work the music scene in Seattle. We do two or three shows a week, but we don't make enough to make a living at it. We are currently working on our debut album, so be looking for that on iTunes and SoundCloud soon. We were set to do a Halloween gig a few years ago, and part of the deal was that we were to dress up as a ghoulish band for a party being held at a local bar. I decided that my Gibson guitar wouldn't be the choice of a ghoul, so I went to a local guitar shop and rented a Flying V similar to the one used by Paul Stanley from Kiss. We got to the show and set up. That's the last thing I remember. The band said that I played better than I ever had before, the crowd loved us, and we even got a few referrals for other gigs. I was perplexed to say the least, but I made my peace with it as best I could. I looked around for the guitar I rented to take it back to the store, but I couldn't find it. I asked the band about it, and they remember seeing it, but said that I had taken it home with me. I was scared because this was a $2,000 instrument, and I couldn't afford to pay for it. I even had a rough time with the rental. I went to the shop to explain things, and the guy stopped me in the middle of my sentence. He said that they did not rent me a guitar, nor do they even have a Flying V in stock. I was left even more perplexed than before. Now I know most of you are thinking, drugs. Well, I do travel the scene, but I've never done drugs seriously and had had nothing that night. We don't even drink beer while we're gigging. It's a band rule. I know this story is unbelievable, and I offer no explanation. I have not had anything like it happen before or since. Jesse Richardson from Seattle, Washington. Jesse, I have no idea how to respond to that. I will put this into the category of lost time, but it goes well beyond that. The facts are there. The substance is there. Was it a memory gone bad or some kind of possession? Who can say? I will say that I believe your story and hope that one day you find your answer. Well, those are your stories this week. If you have a story and you want to submit it to Ron's Amazing Stories, head to the main website at ronsamazingstories.com, click on the story submission banner, and start typing. Next thing you know, your story will appear on the show, and you can tell all your friends that you are now famous. Thank you for all the submissions that you have made. I love each and every one of them. And now, this. As I said at the top this week, we are returning to our story, Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. Since we only have a few chapters to go and it's been a while, I thought I would just take a second to recap. The Nipe is an alien creature that was forced to crash land his ship on Earth. Its culture is different than ours in that they have more of a hive mind. This causes the Nipe to think that humans are not the dominant creature here and therefore not worth his time or consideration. Because of this, he has killed hundreds of humans over the last 10 years without any remorse or any real malice, much like when we swat a bug or step on a spider. Meanwhile, the leaders of our world have tolerated the Nipe's behavior in hopes of capturing the beast and learning its secrets. They have a bioengineered human, Bart Stanton, to hopefully be a match for the creature and to bring him down. Now I will turn the rest over to Mark Nelson. Take it away, Mark.
Next up, More of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. In Chapter 15, Bart Stanton continued his physical and mental preparations for his eventual confrontation with the Knipe. Dr. Yoritomo has a breakthrough in understanding the Knipe psychology. Anything You Can Do, Chapter 16. Colonel Walther Mannheim unlocked the door of his small suite of rooms in the officers' barracks. God, he was tired. It wasn't so much physical exhaustion as mental and emotional release from the tension he had been under for the preceding few hours. Or had it been years? He dropped his heavy briefcase on a nearby chair, took off his cap, and dropped it on the briefcase. He stood there for a moment, looking tiredly around. Everything was in order as usual. He seldom came to Government City anymore. 20 or so visits in the last 10 years, and only a dozen of them had been long enough to force him to spend the night in his old suite at the World Police Headquarters at the southern end of the island. He didn't like to stay in Government City. It made him uneasy, being this close to the Knipe's underground nest. The Knipe had too many taps into government communication channels, too many ways of seeing and hearing what went on here in the nerve center of civilization. One of the most difficult parts of this whole operation had been the careful balancing of information flow through those channels that the Knipe had tapped. To stop using them would betray immediately to that alien mind that his taps had been detected. The information flow must go on as usual. There was no way to censor the information either, although it was known that the Knipe relied on them for planning his raids. But since there was no way of knowing, even after years of observation, what sort of thing the Knipe would be wanting next, there was no way of knowing which information should be removed from the tapped channels. And most certainly, removing all information about every possible material that the Knipe might want would make him even more suspicious than simply shutting down the channels altogether. To shut them down would only indicate that the human government had detected his taps. To censor them heavily would indicate that a trap was being laid. It was even impossible to censor out news about the Knipe. That, too, would have invited suspicion. So a special corps of men had been set up, a group whose sole job was to investigate every raid of the Knipe. Every raid produced a flurry of activity by this special group. They rushed out to look over the scene of the raid, prowled around, and did everything that might be expected of an investigative body. Their reports were sent in over the usual channels. All the actual data they came up with was sent straight through the normal channels, but the conclusions they reached from that data were not. Always, in spite of everything, the messages indicated that the police were as baffled as before. All other information relating to the Knipe went through special channels known to be untapped by the Knipe. And yet there was no way to be absolutely certain of the sum total of the information that the Knipe received. Believing, as he did, in the existence of real people, he would necessarily assume that their communication systems were hidden from him, and the more difficult they were to find, the more certain he would be that they existed. And it was impossible to know what information the Knipe picked up when he was out on a raid, away from the spying devices that had been hidden in his tunnels. Mannheim walked across the small living room to the sideboard that stood against one wall and opened a door. Fresh ice, soda, and a bottle of scotch were waiting for him. He took one of the 10-ounce glasses, dropped in 3 of the hard frozen cubes of ice, added a precisely measured 1.5 ounces of scotch, and filled the glass to within an inch of the brim with soda. Holding the glass in one hand, he walked around the little apartment, checking everything with a sort of automatic abstractedness. The air conditioner was pouring sweet, cool, fresh air into the room. The windows, heavy, thick slabs of paraglass welded directly into the wall, admitted the light from the courtyard outside, but admitted nothing else. There was no need for them to open because of the air conditioning. A century before, some buildings still had fire escapes running down their outsides, but modern fireproofing had rendered such anachronisms unnecessary. But his mind was only partly on his surroundings. He went into the bedroom, sat down on the edge of the bed, took a long drink from the cold glass in his hand, and then put it on the nightstand. Absently, he began pulling off his boots. His thoughts were on the executive session he had attended that afternoon. "How much longer do you think, Colonel?" "A few weeks, sir, perhaps less." "There was another raid in Miami, Colonel. Another man died. We could have prevented that death, Colonel. We could have prevented a great many deaths in the past 6 years." And what answer was there to that? The Executive Council knew that the deaths were preventable in only one way, by killing the Nipe. And they had long ago agreed that the knowledge in that alien mind was worth the sacrifice. But as he had known would happen when they made the decision 6 years before, there were some of them who had, inevitably, weakened. Not all, not even a majority, but a minority that was becoming stronger. It had been, to a great degree, Mannheim's arguments that had convinced them then, and now they were tending to shift the blame for their decision to Mannheim's shoulders. Most of the executives were tough-minded, realistic men. They were not going to step out now unless there were good reason for it. But if the subtle undercutting of the vacillating minority weakened Mannheim's own resolve, or if he failed to give solid, well-reasoned answers to their questions, then the whole project would begin to crumble rapidly. He had not directly answered the executive who had pointed out that many lives could have been saved if the Nipe had been killed 6 years ago. There was no use in fighting back on such puerile terms. "Gentlemen, within a few weeks we will be ready to send Stanton in after the Nipe. If that fails, we can blast him out of his stronghold within minutes afterwards. But if we stop now, if we allow our judgment to be colored at this point, then all those who have died in the past 6 years will have died in vain." He had gone on, exploring and explaining the ramifications of the plans for the next few weeks, but he had carefully kept it on the same level. It had been an emotional sort of speech, but it had been purposely so, in answer to the sort of emotionalism that the weakening minority had attempted to use on him. Men had died, yes, but what of that? Men had died before for far less worthwhile causes. And men, do what they will die eventually. In the back of his mind, he had recalled the battle cry of some sergeant of the old United States Marines during an early 20th century war. As he led his men over the top, he had shouted, "Come on, you sons of bitches! Do you want to live forever?" But Mannheim hadn't mentioned it aloud to the Executive Council. Had he pointed out that 10,000 times as many people had died during the same period through preventable accidents, that would not have been the effect he wanted. These particular men had died for this particular purpose. They had not asked to die. They had not known that they were being sacrificed. None of them could be said to have died a hero's death. They had died simply because they were in a particular place at a particular time. They had been allowed to die for a specific purpose. To abort that purpose at this time would be to make their deaths retroactively murder. Mannheim put his head on the pillow and lifted his feet up on the bed. All he wanted was a few minutes of relaxation. He'd get ready for sleep later. He pressed the control button on the bed frame that lifted the head of the bed up so that he was in a semi-reclining position. He picked up his drink and took a second long pull from it. Then he touched the phone switch and put the receiver to his ear. "Beta, beta," he said when he heard the tone. He heard the hum, and he knew that the ultra-private phone on the desk of Dr. Farnsworth in St. Louis was signaling. Then Farnsworth's voice came over the linkage. "F here." "M here," Mannheim replied. Then he asked guardedly, "Any sign of our boy?" "None." "Keep on him," Mannheim said. "Let me know immediately." "Will do. Any further?" "No. Carry on." Mannheim cut off the phone. Where the hell had Stanton disappeared to, and why? He had wanted to bring the young man to Government City to show him off before the executives. It would have helped. But Stanton had disappeared. Mannheim was well aware that Stanton had been in the habit of leaving the Institute for long walks during the evenings, but this was the first time he had been gone for 24 hours. And even Yoritomo, that master psychologist, had been unable to give any solid reason for Stanton's disappearance. "You must remember, my dear Colonel," Yoritomo had said, "our young Mr. Stanton is a great deal more complex in his thinking than is our friend the Knipe." A hell of a job for a police officer, Mannheim thought to himself. "I know where the criminal is, but I have to hunt for the only cop on earth who can arrest him." He drained his glass, put it on the nightstand, and closed his eyes to think. An operator on duty at the spy screens that watched every move of the Knipe while he was in the tunnels underneath Government City thumbed down a switch and said, "All stations alert. Subject is moving southward toward exit, carrying raiding equipment." It was all that was necessary. The Knipe could not be followed after he left his lair, but the proper groups would be standing by. Somewhere the Knipe would hit and raid again. Somewhere there were human lives in danger. All anyone could do was wait. Cautiously and carefully, the Knipe lifted his head out of the cool salt water of the Hudson River, near the point where it widened into New York Harbor, still so called after the city that had been the greatest on the North American continent before the violence of a sun bomb had demolished it forever. He looked around carefully to get his bearings, then submerged again. The opening into the ancient sewer was nearby. Once into that network, he would know exactly where he was heading. It had taken weeks to find his way around within the unexplored maze of the old sewers, and he had been uncertain whether they would lead him to the place he intended to visit, but luck had been with him. Now he knew exactly where he wanted to go, and exactly what he would find there. He had avoided Government City itself since his first appearance there, shortly after his arrival, just as he had, as much as possible, avoided ever striking in the same place more than once. But now that it had become necessary, he went about his work with the same cool determination that had always marked his activities. He knew his destination, too. He knew the two rooms thoroughly, having explored them carefully and gone away undetected. And now that he knew the one he sought was in those rooms, he was ready to make his final investigation of the man. He swam on through the utter blackness of the brackish water until his head broke surface again. Then he went on along the great conduits that were above the level of the sea. Captain Davidson Greer sat in the gun tower that overlooked the officers' barracks and the courtyard surrounding the five-story building. He was a tall, solidly built man in his early 30s, with dark gray-green eyes and dark blonde hair. He didn't particularly care for gun tower duty, but this sort of thing couldn't be left to anyone who was not in on the secret of the Knipe. As long as Colonel Mannheim was here in Government City, there would be special officers guarding him instead of the usual guard contingent. Not that Captain Greer was actually expecting the Knipe to make any attempt on the Colonel's life. That was too remote to be worried about. But the gun towers had been erected 50 or more years before, because there were always those who wanted to attempt assassination. Officers of the World Police had not enjoyed great popularity during the Reconstruction period after the Holocaust. The petty potentates who had set themselves up as autocratic rulers in various spots over the earth had quite often decided that the best way to get the WP off their backs was to kill someone, and quite often that someone was a police officer. Disgruntled nationalists and fanatics of all kinds had tried at various times to kill one officer or another. The protection was needed then. but now there were occasional assassins who attempted to invade World Police headquarters, but they were usually stopped long before they got into the enclosure itself. Still, there was always the chance. There had been, in the past few years, an undercurrent of rebellion all over Earth because of the Nipe. The monster hadn't been killed, and there were those who screamed that the failure was due to the inefficiency of the police. One attempt had already been made on the life of a Major Thorensen, because he had failed to get the Nipe after a raid in Leopoldville. The would-be assassin had been cut down just before he threw a grenade that would have killed a half a dozen men. Captain Greer had been assigned to make sure that no such attempt would succeed with Colonel Mannheim. He could see the length of the hallway that led to Colonel Mannheim's suite. The hallway had been purposely designed for watching from the gun tower. To one who was inside, it looked like an ordinary hallway, stretching down the length of the building. But it was walled with a special plastic that, while opaque to visible light, was perfectly transparent to infrared. To the ordinary unaided eye, the walls of the building presented a blank face to the gun tower. But to the eye of an infrared scope, the hallways of all five floors looked as though they were long, glass-enclosed terraces. And those walls were neither the ferro-concrete of the main building nor the pressure glass of the windows, but ordinary, heavy-gauge plastic. To the bullets that could be spewed forth from the muzzle of the heavy-caliber, high-powered machine gun in the tower, those walls were practically non-existent. Captain Greer surveyed the hallways with his infrared binoculars. Nothing. The halls were empty. He lowered the binoculars and lit a cigarette. Then he put his eyes to the aiming scope of the gun and swiveled the muzzle a little. The aiming scope showed nothing either. He leaned back and exhaled a cloud of smoke. Colonel Mannheim blinked and looked at the ceiling. It took him a minute to reorient himself. Then he grinned rather sheepishly, realizing that he had dozed off with his clothes on. Even worse, the pressure at his hip told him that he hadn't even bothered to take his sidearm off. He sat up and swung his feet to the floor, then glanced at his wrist. 3 in the morning. "And the moral of that, my dear Walther," he told himself, "is that a tired man should put on his pajama first before he lies down and drinks a scotch." He stood up. Might as well put his pajamas on and get to bed. He would have to be back in St. Louis by 10 in the morning, so he ought to get as much sleep as possible. The phone chimed. He scooped it up and became instantly awake as he heard the voice of Captain Greer from the gun tower that faced the outer wall. "Colonel, the Nipe is just outside the wall of your apartment in the hallway. I have him in my sights." He was trying to stay calm, Mannheim could tell by his voice, but he rattled the words off with machine gun rapidity. Mannheim thought rapidly. Whatever the Nipe was up to, it wouldn't include planting a bomb or anything that might kill anyone accidentally. If there was a life in danger, it was his own, and the danger would come from the Nipe's hands, not from any device or weapon. He was thankful that it was Captain Greer up in that tower, not an ordinary guard who would have fired the instant he saw the alien through the infrared transparent walls. Even so, he knew that the captain's fingers must be tightening on those triggers. No human being could do otherwise with that monster in his sights. Mannheim spoke very calmly and deliberately. "Captain, listen very carefully. Do not, I repeat, do not, under any circumstances whatever, fire that gun. Understand?" "Yes, sir." "What's he doing?"
"I can't tell, sir. He has some sort of gadget in his hands, but he just seems to be squatting there."
"At the door?"
"No. To the left of it, at the wall."
"You have your cameras going?"
"Yes, sir."
"All right. Get everything that happens. Under no circumstances, shoot or give the alarm, even if he kills me. Let him go. I don't think that will happen, but if it does, let him go. I think I can talk to him. I don't think there's much danger.
I'm going to leave the phone open so you can record everything, and— There was a muffled noise from the living room. He heard Captain Greer's gasp as he turned. He could see through the bedroom door to the wall of the living room. A large section of the ferro-concrete wall had sagged away and collapsed, having suddenly lost its tensile strength. On the top of the rubble, frozen for a long instant, stood the Knipe, watching with those four glowing violet eyes. Mannheim let go the phone and turned to face the monster, and in that instant he realized his mistake. The Knipe stared at the human being. Was this, at last, a real person? It was surprising that the man should be awake. Only a minute before, the instruments had shown him to be in the odd cataleptic state that these creatures lapsed into periodically, similar to, but not identical with, his own rest state. And yet he was now awake and fully dressed. Surely that indicated— And then the man turned, and the Knipe saw the weapon in the holster at his waist. There was a blinding instant of despair as he realized that his hopes had been shattered, and he launched himself across the room. Colonel Mannheim's hand darted toward the gun at his hip. It was purely reflex action. Even as he did it, he was aware that he would never get the weapon out in time to bring it to bear on the onrushing monster, and he was content that it should be so. 25 minutes later, the Knipe, after carefully licking off the fingers of his first pair of hands, went back into the hallway and headed down toward the sewers again. The emotion he felt is inexpressible in human terms. Although he had not wished to kill the man, it cannot be said that the Knipe felt contrition. Although he had had no desire to harm the family, if any of the late Colonel Mannheim, it cannot be said that the Knipe felt sadness or compassion. Nor again, although his stomach churned and his body felt sluggish and heavy, can it be said that he felt any regret for what he had done. That is not to say that he felt no emotion. He did. His emotions were as strong and as deep as those of a very sensitive human being. His emotions could bring him pain, and they could bring him pleasure. They could crush him or exalt him. His emotions were just as real and as effective as any human emotions. But they were not human emotions. They were emotions, but not human emotions. It is impossible to render into any human terms the simple statement, "The Knipe felt that he had properly rendered homage to a validly slain foe." That cannot even begin to indicate the emotion the Knipe felt as he moved down toward the sewer and escape. Captain Davidson Greer, his eyes staring with glassy hatred through the infrared gun sight, was registering a very human emotion. His trigger fingers were twitching spasmodically, squeezing, squeezing, squeezing. But his fingers were not on the triggers.
Well, didn't see that coming. Next week, more of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. In this edition, Tom continues with
Growing Up, Southern Living Part 2. I mentioned before living in Grandpa's old general store next to Grandma's big house. I love that big house, as I called it. It was the largest house in Whistler, a few miles outside of Mobile. It had those high ceilings which kept the rooms cool in the summer. My great-grandfather was in the Civil War, and after being released from a prison camp in Mississippi, he returned to his home in Mobile. He started out delivering firewood to the homes and later expanded into a general store downtown on Cherry and Lyons. He could never read or write, we found out later on, but he did well. When his adopted daughter inherited her father's land, great-grandfather took over the child's estate. He moved out to Whistler and bought 5 houses to be rented out to the workers over at the shop, as they called it, with B&O Railroad, and he built the big house for him and his family. Next door, he built a second general store where we lived for a while, as mentioned. I remember Grandma had an outhouse out back. She had a large cast-iron pot where on Mondays she would go out back and start a fire under the pot. There she would do her wash all day with lye soap and a washboard. The water was so boiling hot she had to pour the wash out with a stick. The laundry would hang out to dry on clotheslines. "Don't be playing out there under my clean clothes," she would tell us kids. So we always had to avoid that. Years later, my dad said to his mom, "Mom, I'm going to build you a bathroom on your back porch." I've never seen someone so shocked at the thought. "Who would do such an unhygienic idea like that?" she asked. Dad was finally, with a clear explanation, able to convince her it would be okay to bring an outhouse into your home. The corner property was large enough to ride our friend's horse around on, and after seeing a cowboy movie, I believe it may have been Roy Rogers, Cousin Fred got his great idea. Roy Rogers escaped his pursuers by standing on the horse's back and jumping to an overhead limb of a tree. Fred wanted to do that too. Now, to keep the horse from going back to the barn, which was about a half mile away, guess who was to grab the riderless horse as he came by? Me. Why, the size of that oncoming, big as an elephant horse, to a 7-year-old made me decide otherwise. Now, Fred made the jump as Roy Rogers did, but guess who couldn't stop that runaway horse? Me. Fred wasn't too happy with me for a while, but as it goes with kids, we never stayed mad at each other longer than it took us to think of something else to do. My cousin Fred was highly admired by me as a child. He could run faster. He could swim. I couldn't. He could climb the highest tree and was fearless. At about the age of 7, he got into a phase of climbing any tree he could. Any time Mom came out of the old house where we lived and was looking for Fred, he always looked, or I should say, Mom always looked up into the trees first and called, "Fred, come out of there, come down, and get something to eat. I know you're up there." And sometimes it worked. She once coaxed him down out of the tree with a promise of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Reluctantly, he came down. But Mom forgot that she didn't have any jelly anymore, and handing Fred the peanut butter sandwich without jelly, he felt he was being defrauded somehow and smeared the peanut butter all over her freshly cleaned window out of spite. Mom said to him, "You'll want that peanut butter sandwich one day." I remember one day, down at the branch where we always went to play, fearless Fred came up with another grandiose idea. There are hundreds of 50-foot pine trees down there, and so he decided to climb one and to the very top and start it swaying back and forth and back and forth, which he did, until he had enough momentum and angle to grab the other 50-foot pine tree top adjacent to his and transfer his skinny little body over to it. I'd never do that, but this was entertainment for Fred. Besides, I justified my staying on the ground below by being the one who could call the ambulance if he didn't work out. It did. So here's to the good old peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with a tall glass of milk salute. Sincerely, Tom.
One thing I'm learning about growing up from Tom is how things have changed. I wonder if today's kids would consider their environment a plaything. You know, like Fred did with his tree. I know that as a kid I had to do that, or I would just get bored and then get into trouble. Sometimes that trouble would come from what we decided to do. I remember one day we wanted to go out and play the Wild Wild West. That was a hit TV show of the time. We went to my dad's workshop and took all kinds of tools, parts, or anything that we could hide in our clothes to use like Jim West did. Of course, while playing, these props got lost and never made it back to the workshop. Now, my dad didn't think much of my explanation or play ideas, and punishment was to follow. Thank you, Tom, for your stories, and thank you for reminding us how playtime should be. Without the theft of personal property, of course. That is the podcast this week. I want to thank Christopher Evans, Francis Pittman, Jesse Richardson, Mark Nelson, and Tom Williams for taking part today. Up next week, we will finish off the rest of the spooky stories sent in and have some even more good stuff. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find everything you need. We are on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many, many other services. Please leave reviews and feedback about the show. It really helps us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.